Well, another issue that you talk about in this section of practical issues regarding missing data is the use of auxiliary variables. And why would you say that's important?
This is an interesting issue. This is one that's I just find so interesting. It's the idea with auxiliary variables is that, well, you start off with a situation where you have some partial data. Like, for example, let's just say you have a program variable and an outcome, let's just say cigarette smoking. So let's say you have 1,000 cases who have data for the program variable, but due to attrition or whatever, you only have follow-up data on a smoking measure for 500. So you've got 500 missing cases, and that means you've got missing information on the the parameter estimate that you're trying to get, the regression weight, the B weight from program predicting smoking. You've got missing information on 500 cases, so half the information is missing off of that. Well, then you can kind of imagine, well, suppose you were to say, okay, well, I didn't get those 500 people in the main measure. What if I follow them up and I track them down and I get the information, I get the data on them?
Okay.
Well, that the data you would collect on them would be pretty much the same as if they had been there in the first place.
Right.
So the idea is that now you have this other information that is used in place of the information you didn't have, the lost information from the missing data. And we can see from that situation that it's you've restored a lot of the lost information. Well, one of the things that makes that work is that the correlation between the data you pick up after the fact and the original dependent variable measure of cigarette smoking, that correlation is really high. And so whenever you have a variable like that that's correlated really highly with the variable of interest that has missing data, you can restore some of that lost information. So this new variable we collected, that's an auxiliary variable. And the nice thing about this is that those variables can come from a lot of different places. They don't, that what I just described was a situation we'd like to be able to do a lot, but we can't really do it. But a lot of times we can kind of do it the other way around. Sometimes a variable will already exist in our data set that we can use as a good auxiliary variable. Good example of this is, suppose we have a program variable, and say in seventh grade we delivered a program, and then in ninth grade we were going to measure the final outcome of cigarette smoking, but 50% of the people were missing.
Right.
Well, what if we went back to eighth grade? If we went back to eighth grade smoking, we probably already have that variable because it's a longitudinal study, panel study where we measure the same people over time.
Sure.
Well, we have this eighth grade measure, and maybe most of the people have data for eighth grade smoking. And then we look at the correlation between them, and we say, well, correlation, it's not one, but it's probably pretty high. It's probably like 0.7, maybe even as high as 0.75. Okay, what that means is that we're, by incorporating that eighth grade measure of cigarette smoking into our analysis, this auxiliary variable, we can actually restore some of the lost power to our analysis.
Sure.
And that's, I think that's the key, restoring lost power and actually lowering any kind of estimation bias that might come from the missing data on the ninth grade smoking variable.
I see. Okay.
Restore lost power and reduce estimation bias. Now, auxiliary variables are our friend.
Okay, good. So we should include those.
Yes.
Another kind of real-world practical issue regarding these strategies that you discuss in the article has to do with including interaction terms. And that can maybe seem daunting to someone who's trying to use these methods. When you do an analysis, let's say, and you use imputed data and eventually decide, oh, I think I want to interact gender with this particular independent variable, what are the implications for that in terms of these particularly MI strategies?
Yeah, this is a big issue. One of the basic rules of multiple imputation is that any variable that's going to be in the analysis should be in the imputation model. And that means that if you have a variable, an interaction that you would like to include in your analysis, you better include that interaction in your imputation model. But as you say, that can be kind of daunting. I mean, if you, especially if you've already done the imputation and you realize, oh gosh, I want to I want to add this interaction with gender, you have to go back and re-impute and include that interaction in the model. So a couple of things you can say is that you would need to, well, let me first say why that's important.
Okay.
One of the things that happens is that any variable that's omitted from the imputation model, so if a variable is omitted from the imputation model, then the imputation is done under the model that the correlation is zero between the omitted variable and all the variables that are in the model.
Okay.
that often is a very bad thing, especially if you're trying to find an interaction. If you didn't have an interaction in the imputation model, and then you decide later you want to do it, that you're suppressing the result of that towards zero, so you're making it even less likely you're going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that can be hard to do and hard to anticipate. You really have to sort of anticipate every, say, product term and throw them into the imputation model, and also that adds a lot of variables.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, there is one approach to this that, especially for certain classes of variables, that can be very helpful and relatively manageable. Well, you could just take the gender example first. One of the things you can do is to impute separately within the two genders. So if you imputed separately within males and females,
yes,
then what that does is that it preserves the mean difference between and all the correlation differences within males and females. You can have differences in correlations, and that is actually the definition of an interaction.
Okay, sure.
Different correlation in the two groups.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're allowing those correlations to be different, you're not pushing them to be the same,
mm-hmm.
then that means that you essentially have included all possible interactions with gender in your imputation model.
Mm-hmm.
And making one split like that, males within females, is mm-hmm. usually possible without too much trouble.
Sure.
It's when you get too many, like if you wanted to add program
right.
is another one, program within control. But now if you wanted to do program males, program females, control males,
yes.
control females, now you're starting to get a little bit complicated.
So a three-way interaction then becomes
right.
complicated.
It gets harder, and the bigger it gets hard very fast. So.
Okay.
But there are, you can certainly do regular interactions pretty easily this way.
Okay, good. I also wanted to talk a little bit about, it seems like your discussion so far is focused on normal continuous data. How well do these strategies work if you have other types of data, which for many researchers, particularly in substance use and prevention, will probably be, you know, they may be categorical or definitely skewed and maybe not normal. What kind of advice do you have for those users?
I think the bottom line is that normal model multiple imputation works pretty well with everything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's always best if you have data that don't conform to the normal model. It's probably, you know, it's going to be best if you can develop an imputation model that really is tailored to that kind of that kind of data. Categorical data is a really good example. There are models. One of Joe Schaefer's models, called the CAT program, is
mm-hmm.
you know, for categorical data.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we face a lot of times is that the other models are not so well known, and they're not as available as the normal model multiple imputation. So what you end up having to do is to use what you have available.
Okay.
Fortunately, it turns out that normal model MI works pretty well with everything. It works pretty well with categorical data. Two-level categorical data, for example, is no problem at all. You just, if you have a variable like gender, it's got 0 and 1, you just put that into the model as if it were continuous, and the model works just fine. It's all based on correlations, and so any variable for which a correlation is meaningful, you can just include it in the model.
Sure.
If you have a categorical variable that has more than two levels, you have to dummy code the categorical. So if you've got four categories, you would have to include three dummy variables.
Okay.
And the three dummy variables would then be included in the imputation model.
Right.
You can always reconstruct it back to its original form after imputation.
Mm-hmm.
And with the two-level variables, the two-level categorical variables, you can impute those if there's missing values.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens is that you can actually do the imputation with if you have more than two levels as well.
Okay.
But one of the things that happens, and it just the normal thing, that the imputed value almost never falls right on the zero or one category.
Right.
So it's usually somewhere else. And sometimes you can just leave it like that. Like, one of the things I often say is that if gender, for example, is just going to be used in the model as a covariate, it doesn't hurt just to leave it in that form as the covariate.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're going to use it as something where categorical, it needs to be categorical. If you're going to group the people according to gender, then that would require them having 0 and 1 categories. And that's when you would just round to the nearest legal value.
Sure, okay.
And there are similar things that can be done with categorical variables that have more than two levels.
Okay. What about data that are nested or hierarchical in terms of clustering?
Right, that's a really interesting issue. I've even though my expertise in multi-level models has always been a little bit shaky, I've always found the imputation of multi-level data to be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's best if you have a model that's an imputation model that's designed specifically for multi-level data, but again, mm-hmm. that's not particularly available, and so mm-hmm. we make do with what we can. And again, it turns out that a normal model MI works really well with certain classes of clustered data. For example, if we had a situation with students, children in schools, children within schools, so mm-hmm. we have a lot of times in prevention, we do assignment, the random assignment to conditions. We'll do that at the school level rather than at the kid level.
Right.
Anyway, we go to analyze the data, and what ends up happening is that the kids within a school are more like each other
yes.
than they are like kids outside the school, and that mm-hmm. that lead that's the sort of structure that we want to be able to take into account. Well, you can take care of some of that information by simply dummy coding the school membership. So if there aren't too many schools, you can dummy code the mm-hmm. school membership, and mm-hmm. that dummy coding, what it does is that it allows the means to be different in the school. So you're imputing under a model that allows the means within the schools to be different, and that you're not constraining
right.
the means all to be the same.
Okay.
So this is equivalent to what's known as a random intercepts model mm-hmm. in multi-level analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that approach works really well, mm-hmm. provided you don't have too many schools. I mean, I've mm-hmm. I've handled as many as about 35 schools
okay.
or communities,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to handle it really well. Get above that number, and you're starting to reach the limit of what most of the multiple imputation programs can handle, and then it gets to be more of a problem. Another issue that comes up with multi-level models, though, that
uh-huh.
is not so straightforward, is the idea of random intercepts and random slopes models. That's
yes.
the case where both the means and the covariances are going to be different in across the groups.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it a lot harder for a multiple imputation to handle because
right.
it's really difficult to impute in a way that allows you to allow different correlations within the different clusters. It is possible to impute with, like, if I have one data set where I have 12 schools,
yes.
I could potentially do the imputation separately within each of the 12 schools, and that would preserve
okay.
the different correlations
mm-hmm.
within the 12
schools. Like you talked earlier with gender being...
Yes, like, yes, exactly the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
But when you are stretching it out to the number of schools, the sample size within the schools gets to be small,
right.
so small that the number of variables you can really handle that way gets
mm-hmm.
smaller, and it limits what you can do. And if you've got too many of those categories, like if you've got 100 schools or something, then it gets really difficult to
yes.
compute separately 100 different times and
yeah.
pull the information back together.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, the biggest use of multi-level models is to correct for the differences in means in the clusters, in the schools, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that means that the most common implementation is the random intercepts model. And so
mm-hmm.
that really helps. That
yeah.
Because that's the most common implementation, that
sure.
means that our multiple imputation solution works very well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another common situation that you devote actually an entire section of your book to is regarding attrition. With longitudinal studies. Can you tell us a little bit about what you suggest to the listeners today who are facing this very common problem of maybe, you know, 50% of their sample is gone by wave 4 or wave 5? Are there a couple suggestions you could offer for them? I know you devote an entire section that would be hard to cover in a few minutes, but what's the bottom line in that case?
This is really interesting. I mean, I see my career going in any direction over the next few years, it's going to be this, the study of attrition and
okay.
and the issues surrounding it. So this is a really interesting topic. One of the things I would start with is something I said a little while ago when we're talking about missing at random and missing not at random.
Yes.
Think of that as being a continuum. And attrition is always sort of in this ballpark. People have
mm-hmm.
always feared that that the attrition that they have, you know, especially when it's as high as you're saying, 50%, you know, a lot of people, half your people are gone
yeah.
at the end of the study.
Right.
And if the missingness is not at random, you know, you really worry about how that's going to impact your results.
Sure.
So I want to start with this idea that forget about the idea that it's that, you know, the cause of missingness is MNAR, the cause of missingness is MAR, and remember that it's somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
And instead of doing that, what I want to do is just focus on this idea that we're going to focus on the bias. We're going to say, okay, how much bias are we getting due to the missing data, the attrition that we're seeing in this context? And then we can usually figure that out. We can get a sense of how much bias there would be, and we can do simulations that sort of model the situation that we are seeing in our data.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I tried to do in the 2009 paper was to develop and kind of the beginnings of a taxonomy for attrition, and I really think that's what we need to be doing here. We, mm-hmm. we need to. I came up with like eight categories, eight ways of thinking, eight contexts, you might say, of attrition, and then I think we can spend some time working on those eight and try to say, well, now, if we had this situation under these circumstances, what would the effect on our statistical conclusions be?
Okay.
One really important study was done recently by Colin Schaefer and Kamm, really. Worked very hard on one of those eight categories, and they showed some, I thought, really interesting things. They showed very small amounts of attrition bias,
mm-hmm.
even with 50% attrition, and it was like that was the thing that really opened my eyes, and I'm starting to see, well, whoa, like, you know, those circumstances, that's not bad at all. That looks pretty darn good for our statistical conclusions, and that was really what got me started down this road of realizing, well, there's not just one, but there's like these eight different ways that you can have missing data due to attrition, and if we can model that in simulations, we can really figure out what the problem is. I think the bottom line is we need to know when the attrition is really there. I mean, the bias is really there, and it's really going to affect our conclusions. Or when we can refer to the bias as being or having a tolerably small effect on our statistical conclusions. And I think we're going to find that that tolerably small circumstance really comes up a lot more often than what we used to think.
Okay.
And I think one of the things I do in the 2009 paper is that I admonish people who are doing simulations to be very careful about choosing the parameters of their simulation so that they really reflect reality. And you know, as much as I've gone through this myself, I know I've chosen some really weird parameters for a simulation, so I know how it can happen. But sometimes the parameters that have been chosen in simulations that are have been published are just not anywhere near close to reality, and they give a sense of the problems with attrition that are kind of overstated.
Okay.
And what I admonish people to do is to really pick very realistic parameter values so that the results will really be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I noticed in your 2009 article that you also talk about what I may consider kind of a crazy idea, which is, you know, actually incorporating missing data into the design of a study. That seems a little crazy because we just spent the last several minutes or more talking about how to deal with missing data, and now you're suggesting that maybe from the very beginning a researcher can start out with missing data. What's the story behind that?
Boy, the number of times I've heard that statement. Why would you want to cause missing data? Why would you want to design it in?
Exactly.
Topic of planned missing data designs is something that I really like the idea of this, and it's this first came up in 1982. I had only been at this research institute for a year or so, and we just got the first large scale multiple drug use prevention study funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and what we were going to be in is the Los Angeles Unified School District. It's a huge study, really large, and we had like four people working on the study, four PIs. I'm counting myself as the fourth one. I wasn't a PI at the beginning of that study, but there were at least four of us writing questions on the questionnaire.
Okay.
And our questionnaire was like, you know, 300 items long.
A typical survey.
Very typical. It's and especially when you have multiple people, multiple principal investigators, it's what are you going to throw away?
Everybody wants their questions.
Right.
They're dear to their hearts. And
and we just couldn't get the questionnaire down to an amount small enough that the kids would respond to it. So I came up with this harebrained scheme that we could actually have three forms of the questionnaire, and that a third of the questions, we had this big block that we were going to do this with. One of the blocks, everybody got those questions on say, substance use, recent substance use. But all the other questions in the questionnaire, a third of the people didn't get one set, another third didn't get another set, and another third didn't get another set. And by doing it that way, we were actually able to estimate correlations for everybody on every, now, I mean, let's say we were actually able to estimate correlations on every pair of variables in the data set. And the thing that made that really good was that we were able to collect data on a third more questions than we could have done if we just used a one-form design. And of course, that was a very tough sell. I remember the people that I was working with at the time said, "Oh, we can't do that. We can't do that." But after I came up with it, after I suggested it three or four more times, they said, "No, it doesn't sound like such a bad idea." I always think about being kind of your back against the wall situation, that you desperately want to ask this number of questions, but you don't have time. Your subject either won't or can't answer that many questions.
Sure.
And so what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
One option is just to ask fewer questions, and that's it. The other option is to ask fewer questions the way I have just, in my three-form design. You ask fewer questions, but in using this design, which means you still get to ask the same number of questions.
Right.
So you still get to collect data on all of those questions.
Right.
Anyway, that's the whole point is to get more bang for your buck. Collect data on more questions given a limited amount of resources. And it's, I have to be very honest, when I first started out doing this, I had no clue. This is 1982. I had no clue how I was going to analyze the data. I just sort of thought, well, this ought to work. And about 10 to 12 years later, I finally came up with a method for analyzing it. And proved to be very good.
Perseverance. Well, very good. I think that's probably a nice place to end our conversation today with kind of maybe just a summary statement. Can you give us kind of the bottom line now on what you think about missing data and what researchers in the real world face and what they can do?
I think that people ought to use the missing data procedures that we've developed, the maximum likelihood procedures and the multiple imputation procedures, and even occasionally the EM algorithm and related procedures. We should use those. Those are available. Everybody should make use of those. I think the fact that SAS and now even SPSS has those things, that all the structural equation modeling programs have a missing data feature built in. It's just making it easier and easier to use it. I just think everybody should, I want that to be our basis. Everybody gets up to that level.
Yes.
And then we can get better from there. But that's a really good place to be, and I'd like to see everybody doing that.
Kind of the benchmark for for everything should at least start there. Very good. So finally, what's next on your plate? Do you have any planned publications that are coming out regarding these topics?
My book. I've been working on a book for a little over a year. It's actually called Missing Data Analysis and Design. I'm contracted with Springer to publish the book. Right now I'm about half finished. I have seven chapters written and approved by the publisher, and figure I'm going to have about 14 chapters. I plan to work very hard over the next 3 months, and I'm hopeful that the book will be finished this year.
Great.
2010.
So wow.
I'm looking forward to it a lot. I like how it's turning out, and I'm very hopeful that it'll be finished soon.
That sounds good. I know I'm looking forward to that, and I'm sure that everyone out there will be looking forward to that as well. So I'd like to thank you today, Dr. John Graham from Penn State University Biobehavioral Health, for joining me today. It's been a very good and interesting discussion. And I would like to note in conclusion that listeners to today's podcast can go to our website, methodology.psu.edu, and find a link to this podcast as well as a list of resources that we will provide for the article that you mentioned today and other sources that our listeners can access. Thank you, John, for joining me today.
Thanks, Michael.
You have been listening to Methodology Minutes, brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State, your source for cutting-edge research methodology in the social, behavioral, and health sciences. This podcast is available on iTunes and at methodology.psu.edu.